Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You heard it here first, everybody. The fiscal cliff is fixed. How do I know, you ask? Oh, for that, you got to stick around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 19th of November. And you are not going to find the real news of this Monday published or broadcast anywhere. Nobody official is going to come right out and say it. But that whole fiscal cliff thing, yeah, it's fixed. Done. Move on. Nothing to see here. Once again, I hear you asking how I know this. Well, I know because the market told me so. The major indices had a field day today, as Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff explains from New York.
Expectations have gotten so low for our politicians that just the fact that congressional leaders met with President Obama is enough to get the market in a tizzy of optimism. Michael Sheldon is chief market strategist at RDM Financial Group.
Previously, it seemed like each side had drawn a line in the sand, but now they're at least talking.
That's all it took for the market to rally today. Michael Feroli is chief U.S. economist at J.P. Morgan. He says the rhetoric Friday sounded more promising than after the debt ceiling debacle last year.
I think we're still kind of trading a little bit on the warm glow of coming out of that meeting.
Feroli thinks there's little chance of a political train wreck this time. There will likely be some sort of deal to avert the fiscal cliff's tax hikes and spending cuts. We just don't know what will be in it.
That deal may involve some austerity that could weigh on the economy.
But many think it's unlikely the lame duck Congress will strike a grand bargain before next year. Joseph Carson of AllianceBernstein thinks it'll play out over many months.
First step is a stopgap solution. Second step is probably more meaningful discussions on more comprehensive reform.
But none of that will be worked out this week. Congress is out of town for Turkey. President Obama is in Asia. So let the traders feel good until we get back to business after Thanksgiving. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Anticipation over the fixing of the fiscal cliff is second this week only to the frenzy that will befall us on Friday. The shopping spectacular that comes so reliably the day after Thanksgiving. And as Marketplace's Eve Tro tells us, the juggernaut just keeps on a-growing.
Like it or not, Black Friday is now an inescapable event because where there are packs of wild deal hunters, there's opportunity for companies you may think would stay home on Black Friday. Lindsay Merlin works for Lucky 415, a guerrilla marketing firm that promotes all kinds of things on that dark day.
Promotions for some large insurance companies. We've done some new TV shows, even promoting for restaurants and over-the-counter medicines.
And to reach those crowds, her street teams have to show up early, too.
They're going to get up at 2 or 3 a.m., so it's cold in most places, and then they're 8 to 10 hours on their feet walking around, passing out samples.
Black Friday has come to mean captive audience. Jonathan Margolis works for alternative marketing firm Michael Allen. He says it's a perfect day for publicity stunts for any type of product.
Branded vehicles, such as food trucks. We do outside projections, we do floor stenciling, targeting Black Friday shoppers.
Restaurants and cafes next to retailers are catching on more, too. Jenny McCabe is with Seattle's Best Coffee.
Coffee and shopping, especially waking up really early to shop, go hand in hand.
Seattle's Best is running its second Black Friday campaign with free coffee for all retail workers and discounts for shoppers at their cafes.
Being a place where people can take a little bit of a break while they're shopping.
And while they're sitting there, they might just think, maybe Uncle Johnny just needs a coffee gift certificate instead of heading once more into the breach for that sweater sale. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Things got a little bit crazy at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's been a lot of news the past couple of weeks about the leadership transition in China and whether the new guys and the Communist Party are going to be able to make the political changes that being the world's second biggest economy might seem to require. Today, we're going to bring you some perspective on that story from a former party member who had a front row seat to modern China's most historic events. He is 91 years old, and he's an American. His name is Sidney Rittenberg, and he sat down with our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz.
Sidney Rittenberg doesn't know China's new leader, Xi Jinping, but if he's anything like his father, says Rittenberg, China's in good hands. Rittenberg and Xi Zhongxun were close friends in the 1940s when the Chinese Communist Party was in its infancy.
He took me a number of times with him, traveling around in the countryside among the villages. And he knew whose baby was sick, whose grandpa had rheumatism and so on. And he would go to these homes, talk to these families, and they loved him. I just hope that a lot of this rubbed off on the son.
Rittenberg doesn't expect dramatic reforms from China's new set of leaders. He says the revolving door between China's big state-owned enterprises and the party will make it difficult. And that might do for the short term.
But if they have major economic problems, as they may have if they can't reform, and livelihood starts going down, then they're in for it. You know, Chinese are very obedient people, very indulgent of their leaders, up to a certain point. Beyond that point, they are bad business.
If there's any American who knows this firsthand, it's Rittenberg. He was an idealistic Chinese-speaking U.S. soldier when he first came to China in 1945 in the middle of a civil war. He became close to Mao, maybe too close. In 1949, after Mao established the People's Republic of China, Stalin told Mao that Rittenberg was a spy, and Mao promptly threw his American friend into prison. 6 years later, he was released after, as Rittenberg tells it, Stalin did the best thing of his entire life. He died. Later, Rittenberg would go back to prison for 10 more years during Mao's Cultural Revolution. But between his prison stints, he held a great admiration for communist society in China.
Nobody locked their doors. There was a local bank branch on many, many corners. The door was wide open. The currency was stacked up on the table in plain sight of the door. There was no guard. They never had a bank robbery. Never.
In the 1950s, there was mass famine after Mao collectivized agriculture as part of the Great Leap Forward campaign. Rittenberg says all party members were forbidden from standing in line to buy food. They were told to let the people go first. Rittenberg remembers a colleague who broke this rule and then repented.
They had a big meeting where she made a self-criticism, weeping, 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 saying, "I'm not a good communist. I put my children's health above the health of the masses." Now, can you imagine that today? Anything even remotely similar? Today it's get mine.
And that's what seems to bother Rittenberg most about China these days. The party, he says, isn't the same one he joined decades ago. He says now the party is headed by engineers who want to build a strong country and who are profiting from that vision. They're men terrified of the possibility that political and economic reform could lead to instability. He says if they can't overcome their fears, what they fear most will come to pass, threatening the very existence of the party he gave much of his life to. Reporting from Beijing, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
If you want to know more about Sidney Rittenberg and his amazing life, he's the subject of a new documentary that's just out. It's called The Revolutionary, and we've got details about it on our website. It's marketplace.org. There's an oil boom happening out in North Dakota that's brought thousands of people to some of the small towns out there. Overwhelming might be a pretty good word for what's going on. These towns are crowded. Rents have gone sky high. So temporary barracks are being set up. They're called man camps. Thing is, though, there's not a lot for these guys to do except work. So to keep them busy and out of trouble, organizers have brought mixed martial arts to town. Todd Melby is following the oil boom in a project called Black Gold Boom, and he visited the Williston Basin MMA blowout in Williston, North Dakota.
As soon as you're not able to provide an intelligent defense, then the ref will call the match.
Okay. One, two, three. This is big for Williston to have events. As the population grows, we need things to do to keep us out of trouble. Agreed? Yeah.
I like it. I think it's awesome. The fighting, the blood, broken bones, the possibility there's a broken bone.
Our first bout tonight. Let's load up the blue corner, ladies and gentlemen. North Dakota fighter, 6 foot, 140 pounds, Brett Shinnell.
Get nasty, Brett. Get nasty.
Knees, Brett. Knees, knees, knees.
Knees.
There you go, Brett. Hands up, Brett. Hands up.
Hands. Take him down.
I took a nice shot right off the bat in the groin.
We were sitting there at the table saying he's going to come up and whoop shit out of that guy. And he did. Have you a lighter?
There are families here tonight, kids. Let's hold our tongue and make it loud and clear that we're having a good time in a proper way.
Use your elbow! Come on! So beat him.
Elbow!
Beat him! Beat him!
Oh, that was a good one! That boy's got some good swings on him.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty much the gist of our job. Stand around, take pictures. Our face hurts at the end of the night from smiling.
Todd Melby's Black Gold Boom Project is an initiative of Local Lore and the Association of Independents in Radio. We've got some pictures of the Williston Basin blowout on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, cranberries and climate change.
Because of the percentage of rot that was delivered to Ocean Spray, they paid us $2 a barrel less. We delivered 370,000 barrels last year. So you're talking about millions of dollars.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so Wall Street took no bad news about the fiscal cliff as very good news indeed. The Dow Industrials jumped 207 points today, 1.6%, finished at 12,795. The Nasdaq zoomed 62 points higher, 2.2%, 29.16 at the bell. The S&P 500 up 27 points, 2%, ended at 13.86. Bruised Apple was a big factor in that Nasdaq spike. It recovered more than 7% today. Hewlett-Packard printed out a 3.5% increase. Dell gained 3%. Lowe's up 6% today after beating expectations thanks to a better housing market and Hurricane Sandy. Sold a lot of generators and other supplies before and after that giant storm. Its bigger rival, Home Depot, rose nearly 2% today. Tyson Foods fattened up 11% after rising meat prices helped beat estimates. Tyson also raised its regular dividend by 25% and announced a special dividend to boot. Bond price to boot. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.61%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. We'll get our first look at how HP is doing under its new CEO, Meg Whitman. The tech company will tell us how much profit it made between August and October. And tune in tomorrow. Kai will talk to CEO Whitman about her plan for the company. And happy anniversary to Queen Elizabeth and the Prince Consort. They'll be celebrating their 65th wedding anniversary. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama is about halfway through what you can only call a whirlwind tour of Southeast Asia, which included, as you might have heard, a brief but notable visit to Myanmar today. He is the first sitting American president to set foot in that country, also setting foot are American companies, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York.
You may not be opening a company in Myanmar, but if you go as a tourist, you'll understand the hurdles businesses face. Matthew LaPolice specializes in Asia for the firm Absolute Travel.
The experience there is really like you're being transported back in time and kind of seeing a different way of life.
Roads are miserable, amenities are few, you'll also need gangster-sized rolls of money. Credit cards are rarely accepted. The country's first ATM just arrived late last year. An interesting trip, maybe, but tricky territory for a company.
If you have to walk around and do all your transactions in cash, as I had to do on my trip there, you see what a difference it makes.
John Goyer is the Senior Director for Southeast Asia at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is taking a delegation of business leaders to Myanmar in February. Despite the headaches, American firms are heading in. GE, Coke, Pepsi, Visa, MasterCard, and many more are eager to get in on a key piece of Asian real estate.
If you look at a map, you see where Myanmar, Burma, is situated, and you understand that it's situated square in the middle of the highest growth and development area on the planet.
Richard Sawoya is director of USA Engage, a business group that opposes trade sanctions. The opening of Myanmar puts an energy-rich nation of more than 50 million people on the business map, something unthinkable during the height of harsh military rule.
For several years, this business environment was terribly bleak for anyone but a small circle of people who were favored.
Kevin Murphy is managing director of Andaman Capital Partners, which advises investors doing business in Myanmar. He spoke by phone from Yangon, the country's largest city.
To see American flags flapping on the main streets here is a pretty remarkable thing after many years of being at loggerheads.
Remarkable, but only the first step in what will be a long journey for American companies hoping to profit from Myanmar's opening. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Taxes are a pretty touchy topic in this economy right now. New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore talks about the history and the present of the income tax in the latest edition of that magazine. It started, she writes, with an earthquake. San Francisco, 1906, followed by the financial panic of 1907, followed by the 16th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States that provided for the income tax. Wasn't really all that controversial back then. It is, oh, so much more so now, as she talks about in her piece. Jill Lepore, it's really good to have you with us.
Hey, good to be here.
How did we get to the point in this country, and this gets actually to the very serious crux of this article, how did we get to the point in this country where you can only talk about taxes going down, not up?
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? Because mathematically, that's just a problem. I mean, we talk about this fiscal cliff as if it were a natural disaster, right? Like as if we're on, it's this cliffhanger where we're there about to fall off like Wile E. Coyote. It's not a fiscal cliff. It's a fiscal political contrivance, right? Yeah. Like it's the consequence of a century-long tradition of really refusing to defend taxation.
I wonder if we're still so anti-tax because taxation hasn't been effectively sold to us. I mean, it's, you know, we need in this country the things that taxation gives us, but nobody wants to be taxed to get them.
I think that's exactly the case. But the flip side of that is opposition to taxation has been very effectively sold. There's not a very well-organized defense of it.
Yeah. How come, though? Honestly.
Yeah. That's the, what would it be? That's the 1040 question.
The 1040 question, right? Not the $64,000 question.
Not the $64,000.
It's that Oliver Wendell Holmes quote that you have.
Yeah, taxes are the price we pay for civilized society. No one's really said that better than Oliver Wendell Holmes, and that was nearly a century ago. One argument that historians have made is that the opposition to, for instance, New Deal social programs meant that liberal policymakers very deliberately refused to defend what they were doing as a kind of progressive income tax that would be for the good of all. That to defend it in that way would to open themselves up to further political attack by these well-organized political forces that opposed income taxation at all. Mm. And so they were never defended as the fruit of an income tax and have left us with this very difficult legacy.
Convoluted, yeah. If you believe, as the Democrats would have people believe, that this election was in some way a referendum on the role of government in society, do you think that it means that we are now finally buying into being taxed?
I think what's kind of amazing, when you think about the century beginning with the ratification of the 16th Amendment in 1913 and the amount of energy that has been spent to defeat progressive income taxation, that it survives at all, despite having been so poorly defended, is a testament to Americans' truly abiding sense of fairness.
Is that the marketing slogan then? I mean, fairness and taxation, right? I mean, how do you sell this to the American people?
Well, you know, it it's interesting. I was just reading today that this Republican from Ohio talking about, you know, how great Paul Ryan was because he was so good at selling budgetary policy to the American people. And to think about that, like, just think about rhetorically what that means. Like, everyone in politics has accepted the business metaphor. Like, we are not citizens, we're consumers. It can be defended in this way, right? Taxes protect private property and protect the environment. Without taxes, business is impossible. You can make a business-based argument to defend progressive income taxation. But one way not to do it is to engage in the rhetoric of marketing.
Jill Lepore, she writes on taxes in the current issue of The New Yorker. She teaches American history at Harvard University. Jill, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We have now a story about cranberries. No, not how to make your own cranberry relish. That's a whole different public radio show. We're going to talk about the business of cranberries, which is, honestly, a more delicate business than you might have thought, and which explains why, like a lot of farmers out there, cranberry growers are worried about a warming planet. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Before we start, can we all just agree that cranberries are an acquired taste?
Okay, that's really tart. Wow.
Did you get a dark one?
I should take a darker one? Is that what you're saying?
Dark, light, whatever. They're all bitter, which is why we have those dried cranberries loaded with sugar, craisins. And some of those craisins start right here in a bog not far from Plymouth Bay.
This is the largest bog in the world. There used to be one larger bog than this. It was on Nantucket, but they since put a dike down the middle of it, so this makes this the largest in the world.
That's Glenn Reed, New England Patriots fan, cranberry bog veteran. Reed oversees cranberry operations for a company called AD Makepeace. The founder, Abel Makepeace, started out growing cranberries over 150 years ago. He was known around these parts as the Cranberry King. Today, Makepeace harvests the cranberries by flooding the bogs, then sending in machines that act sort of like giant egg beaters. They stir up the water so the cranberries pop off the vines. Then workers wade into the water nearly waist high, corral the cranberries with floating booms, and hand rake them into pumps that suck the berries right into trucks.
Not only are they working during the day harvesting, but we're going to have a frost tonight. So that means most of my guys are going to be out tonight turning on pumps to protect the berries that haven't been picked yet.
Reed says harvesting cranberries has always been hard work, but nowadays, growing them is even tougher.
The berries actually need cold nights to color up. Last year, we had a big problem with coloring up the berries.
Yeah, what did it look like out there, more white than
red? A lot more white berries, oh yeah.
This year, Reed says the warmer winter tricked the cranberries into budding early, so they had to scramble to protect them from frequent night frosts in March and April. Makepeace's CEO, Michael Hogan, says for now, cranberries are still a viable crop in Massachusetts. But
we're having warmer springs. We're having higher incidence of pests and fungus. Warmer falls when we need to have cooler nights. And we also have pressure about water.
More water for irrigating in the hotter summers, and more in spring and fall for frost protection. More fuel to run the irrigation pumps, more technology to monitor the bogs more closely, more fungicides, and more fruit rot.
And because of the percentage of rot that was delivered to Ocean Spray, they paid us $2 a barrel less. We delivered 370,000 barrels last year. So you're talking about millions of dollars.
Hogan won't talk global warming, but it's clear he and his company are planning for a changing climate. They're investigating more heat-tolerant cranberry varieties. They're consulting with climate specialists like Eric Wahlberg at the Manamet Center for Conservation Sciences near Cape Cod.
Certainly, Makepeace is a bit unique in that they've got a very well-trained staff because of the size of the company. They're able to afford that, and they are actively engaged with Manamet on the question of climate change.
But Wahlberg says farmers all over the country are responding to the changing climate, whether they embrace climate science or not. Makepeace may just be thinking more long-term. In fact, it's already checked out chillier climes like eastern Canada. Ocean Spray has already started growing cranberries in New Brunswick. Hogan's even considering Chile.
They have the appropriate number of degree days for growing, and then they have the cool evenings leading up to the harvest period that give the cranberry the colors that they need.
So, a New England company growing a North American berry in South America?
We're never going to walk away from our core holdings here. It's our roots, it's our heritage, but part of our challenge is to diversify so that we're here for another couple of generations. That will require us to look beyond the boundaries of Plymouth County.
People here can't imagine a time when they won't be growing cranberries. I asked the head of the Cape Cod Cranberry Association, what about 50 years from now? His tart reply, well, I don't think we'll be growing tropical oranges. In Plymouth County, Massachusetts, I'm Sarah Gartner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with my sympathies for those among you who went out on Friday and spent hundreds, nay, thousands of dollars for Twinkies you believed were about to vanish from the earth. I'm sad to say there is news today of a possible deal between Hostess and its bakers. They have agreed to go into mediation to try to avoid the company being shut down and some 18,000 workers losing their jobs. I wasn't kidding about the thousands of dollars thing, by the way. The highest sale price for a box of Twinkies that we saw on eBay, $7,600 for Twinkies. All right, that's enough of that. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 207 points, 1.6%, closed at 12,795. The NASDAQ up 62 points, 2.2%, 2916 at the bell. The S&P 500 added 27 points, 2%, 1386 is where it ended for the day. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Joel Patterson, and Jolie Padokas. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.